The monsoon region. Annual rainfall in the coastal areas is about 200 inches, and the average temperature of those areas is close to 90 degrees. A third of its perimeter is coastline. The writer George Orwell published a novel, Burmese Days, and several essays about life there. What I get from reading them is that Burma is about as far from Minnesota as it's possible to be. Over the next few weeks, as one day grinds into the next, life is quiet and tense. I listen to the radio, scour the Tribune, wait anxiously for the mail drop, and devour Dutchie's letters when they come, scanning quickly for news. Is he okay? Eating well, healthy, and parsing every word for tone and nuance, as if his sentences are a code I can crack. I hold each blue-tinted, tissue-thin letter to my nose and inhale. He, too, held this paper. I run my finger over the words. He formed each one. Dutchie and his shipmates are waiting for orders. Last-minute flight deck drills in the dark, the preparations of sea bags, every corner filled and every piece in place, from rations to ammunition. It's hot in San Diego, but they're warned that where they're going will be worse, almost unbearable.
"I'll never get used to the heat," he writes. "I miss the cool evenings, walking along the street holding your hand. I even miss the damn snow. Never thought I'd say that."
But most of all, he says, he misses me, my red hair in the sun, the freckles on my nose, my hazel eyes, the child growing in my stomach.
"You must be getting big," he says. "I can only imagine the sight."
Now they're on the aircraft carrier in Virginia. This is the last note he'll send before they embark. He's giving it to a chaplain who came on board to see them off.
"The flight deck is 862 feet long," he writes. "We wear 7 different colors to designate our jobs. As a maintenance technician, my deck jersey, float coat, and helmet are an ugly green, the color of overcooked peas."
I picture him standing on that floating runway, his lovely blonde hair hidden under a drab helmet. Over the next 3 months, I receive several dozen letters, weeks after he writes them, sometimes 2 in the same day, depending on where they were mailed from. Dutchie tells me about the tedium of life on board, how his best friend from their basic training days, another Minnesotan named Jim Daly, has taught him to play poker, and they spend long hours below decks with a revolving cast of servicemen in an endless ongoing game. He talks about his work, how important it is to follow protocol, and how heavy and uncomfortable his helmet is, how he's beginning to get used to the roar of the plane engines as they take off and land. He talks about being seasick, and the heat. He doesn't mention combat or planes being shot down. I don't know if he isn't allowed to, or if he doesn't want to frighten me.
"I love you,"
he writes again and again.
"I can't bear to live without you. I'm counting the minutes until I see you."
The words he uses are the idioms of popular songs and poems in the newspaper, and mine to him are no less cliched. I puzzle over the onion skin, trying to spill my heart onto the page, but I can only come up with the same words, in the same order, and hope the depth of feeling beneath them gives them weight and substance. "I love you. I miss you. Be careful. Be safe." Hemingford, Minnesota, 1943. It is 10 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, and I've been in the store for an hour, first going over accounts in the back room, and now walking down each aisle, as I do every day, to make sure that the shelves are tidy and the sale displays are set up correctly. I'm in the back aisle, rebuilding a small pyramid of Jergens face cream that has toppled into a stack of Ivory soap, when I hear Mr. Nielsen say,
"Can I help you?"
in a strange, stiff voice. Then he says sharply,
"Viola."
I don't stop what I'm doing, though my heart races in my chest. Mr. Nielsen rarely calls his wife by her name. I continue building the pyramid of Jergens jars, 5 on the bottom, then 4, 3, 2, 1 on top. I stack the leftover jars on the shelf behind the display. I replace the ivory soap that was knocked off the pile. When I'm done, I stand in the aisle waiting. I hear whispering. After a moment, Mrs. Nielsen calls, "Vivian, are you here?" A Western Union man is standing at the cash register in his blue uniform and black-brimmed cap. The telegram is short. "The Secretary of War regrets to inform you that Luke Maynard was killed in action on February 16, 1943. Further details will be forwarded to you as they become available. I don't hear what the Western Union man says. Mrs. Nielsen has started to cry. I touch my stomach. The baby. Our baby. In the coming months, I will get more information. Dutchie and three others were killed when a plane crashed onto the fleet carrier. There was nothing anyone could do. The plane came apart on top of him.
I hope you will find comfort in the fact that Luke died instantly. He never felt a thing, his shipmate Jim Daly writes.
Later, I receive a box of his personal effects, his wristwatch, letters I wrote to him, some clothes, the Claddagh Cross. I open the box and touch each item, then close it and put it away. It will be years before I wear the necklace again. Dutchie hadn't wanted to tell anyone on base that his wife was pregnant. He was superstitious, he said. He didn't want to jinx it. I'm glad of that. Glad that Jim Daly's letter of condolence is one to a wife, not a mother. The next few weeks I get up early in the morning before it's light and go to work. I reorganize entire sections of merchandise. I have a big new sign made for the entrance and hire a design student to work on our windows. Despite my size, I drive to Minneapolis and walk around the large department stores, taking notes about how they create their window displays, trends in colors and styles that haven't filtered up to us yet. I order inner tubes, sunglasses, and beach towels for summer. Lil and Em take me to the cinema, to a play, out to dinner. Mrs. Murphy invites me regularly for tea, and one night I am woken by a searing pain and know it's time to go to the hospital. I call Mrs. Nielsen as we've planned and pack my small bag, and she picks me up and drives me there. I am in labor for 7 hours, the agony so great in the last stretch that I wonder if it's possible to split in half. I start to cry from the pain, and all the tears I haven't shed for Dutchie come flooding out. I am overcome with grief, with loss, with the stark misery of being alone. I learned long ago that loss is not only probable but inevitable. I know what it means to lose everything, to let go of one life and find another. And now I feel, with a strange deep certainty, that it must be my lot in life to be taught that lesson over and over again. Lying in that hospital bed, I feel all of it. The terrible weight of sorrow, the crumbling of my dreams. I sob uncontrollably for all that I've lost. The love of my life, my family, a future I dared to envision. And in that moment I make a decision. I can't go through this again. I can't give myself to someone so completely, only to lose them. I don't want ever again to experience the loss of someone I love beyond reason. There, there, Mrs. Nielsen says, her voice rising in alarm. If you keep on like this, you'll, she says, go dry. But what I hear is, die. I want to die, I tell her. I have nothing left. You have this baby, she says. You'll go on for this baby. I turn away. I push, and after a time, the baby comes. The little girl is as light as a hen in my arms. Her hair is wispy and blonde. Her eyes are as bright as underwater stones. Dizzy with fatigue, I hold her close and shut my eyes. I have told no one, not even Mrs. Nielsen, what I am about to do. I whisper a name in my baby's ear. May, Maisie, like me. She is the reincarnation of a dead girl. And then I do it. I give her away. Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011. Oh, Vivian, you gave her away? Molly says, leaning forward in her chair. The two of them have been sitting for hours in the wing backs in the living room. The antique lamp between them casts a planetary glow. On the floor, a stack of blue onion skin airmail letters bound with string, a man's gold watch, a steel helmet, and a pair of military-issue socks spill out of a black steamer trunk stamped with the words, U.S. Navy. Vivian smooths the blanket on her lap and shakes her head as if deep in thought. I'm so sorry. Molly fingers the never-used baby blanket, its basket weave design still vivid, the stitches intricately pristine. So Vivian had a baby and gave her away, and then married Jim Daly, Dutchie's best friend. Was she in love with him? Or was he merely consolation? Did she tell him about the baby? Vivian leans over and shuts off the tape recorder. That's really the end of my story. Molly looks at her, puzzled. But that's only the first 20 years. Vivian shrugs lightly. The rest has been relatively uneventful. I married Jim and ended up here. But all those years, good years, for the most part, but not particularly dramatic. Did you... Molly hesitates. Were you in love with him? Vivian looks out the bay window. Molly follows her gaze to the Rorschach shapes of the apple trees, barely visible in the light from the house. I can honestly say that I never regretted marrying him. But you know the rest, so I will tell you this. I did love him. But I did not love him like I loved Dutchie. Beyond reason. Maybe you only get one of those in a lifetime. I don't know. But it was all right. It was enough. It was all right. It was enough. Molly's heart clamps as if squeezed in a fist. The depth of emotion beneath those words... It's hard for her to fathom. Feeling an ache in her throat, she swallows hard. Vivian's resolute unsentimentality is a stance Molly understands all too well. So she just nods and asks, "So how did you and Jim end up together?" Vivian purses her lips, thinking, "About a year after Dutchie died, Jim returned from the war and got in touch with me. He had a few small things of Dutchie's, a pack of cards and his harmonica that the army hadn't already sent. And so it started, you know. It was a comfort to have someone to talk to, I think, for both of us. Another person who knew Dutchie. Did he know you'd had a baby? No, I don't think so. We never talked about it. It seemed like too much to burden him with. The war had taken a toll on him. There were a lot of things he didn't want to talk about, either. Jim was good with facts and figures, very organized and disciplined. Far more than Dutchie was. Honestly, I doubt the store would have done half as well if Dutchie had lived. Is that terrible to say? Well, even so. He didn't care a whit about the store, didn't want to run it. He was a musician, you know, no head for business. But Jim and I were good partners, worked well together. I did the ordering and the inventory, and he upgraded the accounting system, brought in new electric cash registers, streamlined the vendors, modernized it. I'll tell you something. Marrying Jim was like stepping into water the exact same temperature as the air. I barely had to adjust to the change. He was a quiet, decent, hard-working man, a good man. We weren't one of those couples who finish each other's sentences. I'm not even sure I could have told you what was going on in his head most of the time. But we were respectful of each other, kind to each other. When he got irritable, I steered clear, and when I was in what he called one of my black moods, sometimes I'd go days without saying more than a few words, he left me alone. The only problem between us was that he wanted a child, and I couldn't give him that. I just couldn't do it. I told him how I felt from the beginning, but I think he hoped I'd change my mind. Vivian rises from her chair and goes to the tall bay windows. Molly is struck by how frail she is, how narrow her silhouette. Vivian unfastens the silk loops from their hooks at each side of the casing, letting the heavy paisley curtains fall across the glass. I wonder if, Molly ventures cautiously, have you ever wondered what became of your daughter? I think about it sometimes. You might be able to find her. She would be, Molly calculates in her head, in her late 60s, right? She could very well be alive. Adjusting the drape of the curtains, Vivian says, it's too late for that. But why? The question feels like a dare. Molly holds her breath, her heart thumping, aware that she's being presumptuous, if not downright rude. But this may be her only chance to ask. I made a decision. I have to live with it. You were in a desperate situation. Vivian is still in shadow, standing by the heavy drapes. That's not quite true. I could have kept the baby. Mrs. Nielsen would have helped. The truth is, I was a coward. I was selfish and afraid. Your husband had just died. I can understand that. Really? I don't know if I can. And now, knowing that Maisie was alive all these years... Oh, Vivian, Molly says. Vivian shakes her head. She looks at the clock on the mantel. Goodness! Look at the time! It's after midnight! You must be exhausted. Let's find you a bed. Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011. Molly is in a canoe, paddling hard against the current. Her shoulders ache as she digs into the water on one side and then the other. Her feet are soaking. The canoe is sinking, filling with water. Glancing down, she sees her ruined cell phone, the sodden backpack that holds her laptop. Her red duffel topples out of the boat. She watches it bob for a moment in the waves and then slowly descend below the surface. Water roars in her ears, the sound of it like a distant faucet. But why does it seem so far away? She opens her eyes, blinks. It's bright. So bright. The sound of water. She turns her head, and there, through a casement window, is the bay. The tide is rushing in. The house is quiet. Vivian must still be asleep. In the kitchen, the clock says 8 a.m. Molly puts the kettle on for tea and rummages through the cupboards, finding steel-cut oats and dried cranberries, walnuts, and honey. Following the directions on the cylindrical container, she makes slow-cooked oats, so different from the sugary packets Dina buys, chopping and adding the berries and nuts, drizzling it with a little honey. She turns off the oatmeal, rinses the teapot they used the night before, and washes the cups and saucers. Then she sits in a rocker by the table and waits for Vivian. It's a beautiful postcard from Maine morning, as Jack calls days like this. The bay sparkles in the sun like trout scales. In the distance near the harbor, Molly can see a fleet of tiny sailboats. Her phone vibrates. A text from Jack.
What's up?
This is the first weekend in months that they haven't made plans. Her phone brrs again.
Can I see you later?
Tons of homework, she types.
Study together?
Maybe. Call you later.
When?
She changes the subject. Maine postcard day.
Let's hike Flying Mountain. Fuck homework.
Flying Mountain is one of Molly's favorites, a steep 500-foot ascent along a piney trail, a panoramic view of Soames Sound, a meandering descent that ends at Valley Cove, a pebbled beach where you can linger on large, flat rocks, gazing at the sea, before circling back to your car or bike on a fire road carpeted with pine needles. Okay. She presses send and immediately regrets it. Shit. Within seconds, her phone rings.
Hola, chica,
Jack says.
What time do I pick you up?
Can I get back to you?
Let's do it now. Ralph and Dina are holy rolling, right? I miss you, girl. That stupid fight. What was it about, anyway? I forgot already.
Molly gets up from the rocker, goes over and stirs the oatmeal for no reason, puts her palm on the tea kettle, lukewarm. Listens for footsteps, but the house is quiet. Hey, she says, I don't know how to tell you this.
Tell me what?
He says, and then...
Whoa, wait a minute. Are you breaking up with me?
What? No, it's nothing like that. Dina threw me out.
You're kidding.
Nope.
She threw you... When?
Last night.
Last night? So...
Molly can practically hear the wheels turning.
Where are you now?
Taking a deep breath, she says, I'm at Vivian's. Silence.
Did he hang up?
Molly bites her lip. Jack?
You went to Vivian's last night? You stayed at Vivian's?
Yes, I...
Why didn't you call me?
His voice is brisk and accusatory.
I didn't want to burden you.
You didn't want to burden me?
I just mean I've relied on you too much. And after that fight, so you thought, I'll go burden that 90-year-old lady instead. Much better than burdening my boyfriend.
Honestly, I was out of my mind, Molly says. I didn't know what I was doing.
So you hiked over there, did you? Somebody give you a ride?
I took the Island Explorer. What time was it?
Around 7,
she fudges.
Around 7. And you just marched up to her front door and rang the bell? Or did you call first?
All right, that's enough. I don't like your tone, Molly says.
Jack sighs. Look, she says. I know this is hard for you to believe, but Vivian and I are friends.
There's a pause, and then Jack says,
uh-huh.
We have a lot in common, actually.
He laughs a little.
Come on, Mal.
You can ask her.
Listen, you know how much I care about you. But let's get real. You're a 17-year-old foster kid who's on probation. You just got kicked out of another home, and now you've moved in with a rich old lady who lives in a mansion? A lot in common? And my mom, I know, your mom.
Molly sighs loudly. How long is she going to be beholden to Terry, for God's sake?
It's complicated for me, he says.
Well, Molly says, here goes. I don't think it's so complicated now. I told Vivian about stealing the book.
There's a pause.
Did you tell her that my mom knew?
Yeah. I told her you vouched for me and that your mom trusted you.
What'd she say?
She totally understood.
He doesn't say anything, but she senses a shift. A softening.
Look, Jack, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry for putting you in that position in the first place. That's why I didn't call you last night. I didn't want you to feel like you had to save my butt once again. It sucks for you, always doing me a favor, and it sucks for me, always feeling like I have to be grateful. I don't want to have that kind of relationship with you. It's not fair to expect you to take care of me, and I honestly think your mom and I might get along better if she doesn't think I'm trying to work all the angles.
She doesn't think that.
She does, Jack, and I don't blame her.
Molly glances over at the tea service drying in the rack, and I have to say one more thing.
Vivian said she wanted to clean out her attic.
But I think what she really wanted was to see what was in those boxes one last time and remember those parts of her life. So I'm glad, actually, that I was able to help her find these things. I feel like I did something important.
She hears footsteps in the upstairs hall. Vivian must be on her way downstairs. Hey, I've gotta go. I'm making breakfast. She flicks on the gas burner to warm the oatmeal, pouring a little skim milk into it and stirring.
Jack sighs. You're a major pain in the ass. Did you know that?
I keep telling you that, but you don't want to believe me.
I believe you now,
he says.
A few days after Molly arrives at Vivian's, she texts Ralph to let him know where she is. He texts back,
call me.
So she calls. What's up?
You need to come back so we can deal with this.
Nah, that's okay.
You can't just run away, he says. We'll all be in a pile of shit if you do.
I didn't run away. You kicked me out.
No, we didn't, he sighs. There are protocols. Child Protective Services are going to be all over your ass. So will the police if this gets out. You have to go through the system.
I think I'm done with the system.
You're 17. You're not done with the system till the system is done with you.
So don't tell them.
You mean lie?
No, just don't tell them.
He's silent for a moment. Then he says,
you doing okay?
Yep.
That lady is okay with you being there?
Uh-huh. He grunts.
I'm guessing she's not a certified foster care provider.
Not technically.
Not technically.
He laughs dryly.
Shit. Well, maybe you're right. No need to do anything drastic. When are you 18 again?
Soon.
So if it's not hurting us, and it's not hurting you...
That money comes in handy, huh?
He's silent again, and for a moment Molly thinks he's hung up on her. Then he says,
rich old lady, big house. You've done pretty well for yourself. You probably don't want us to report you missing.
So, I still live with you then?
Technically,
he says.
Okay with you?
Okay with me. Give Dina my best.
I'll be sure to do that,
he says.
Terry is not particularly happy to find Molly in the house on Monday morning. What's this? She says, her voice a sharp exclamation.
Jack hasn't told her about Molly's new living arrangements. Apparently, he was hoping the situation would somehow magically resolve itself before his mother found out. "I've invited Molly to stay," Vivian announces, "and she has graciously accepted. So she's not..." Terry starts looking back and forth between them. "Why aren't you at the Thibodeaux's?" she asks Molly. "It's a little complicated there right now," Molly says. "What does that mean?"
"Things are unsettled," Vivian says, "and I'm perfectly happy to let her bunk in a spare room for the moment."
"What about school?"
"Of course she'll go to school. Why wouldn't she?"
"This is very charitable of you, Vivi, but I imagine the authorities..."
"It's all worked out. She's staying with me," Vivian says firmly. "What else am I going to do with all these rooms? Open a bed and breakfast?"
Molly's room is on the second floor, facing the ocean, down a long hall at the opposite side of the house from Vivian's. In the window in Molly's bathroom, also on the ocean side, a light cotton curtain dances constantly in the breeze, sucked toward the screen and out again, billowing toward the sink, an amiable, ghostly presence. How long has it been since anyone slept in this room? Molly wonders. Years and years and years. Her belongings, all that she brought with her from the Thibodeaux's, fill a scant 3 shelves in the closet. Vivian insists that she take an antique roll-top desk from the parlor and set it up in the bedroom across the hall from hers so she can study for finals. No sense in confining yourself to one room when there are all these options, is there? Options. She can sleep with the door open. Wander around freely. Come and go without someone watching her every move. She hadn't realized how much of a toll the years of judgment and criticism, implied and expressed, have taken on her. It's as if she's been walking on a wire, trying to keep her balance, and now, for the first time, she is on solid ground. Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011. "You're looking remarkably normal," Lori, the social worker, says when Molly shows up at the chemistry lab for their usual bi-weekly meeting. "First, the nose ring disappears. Now you've lost the skunk stripe. What's next, an Abercrombie hoodie?" "Ugh, I'd kill myself first." Lori smiles her ferrety smile. "Don't get too excited," Molly says. "You haven't seen my new tramp stamp." "You didn't." It's kind of fun to keep Lori guessing, so Molly just lifts her shoulders in a shrug. "Maybe, maybe not." Lori shakes her head. "Let's have a look at those papers." Molly hands over the community service forms, dutifully filled out and dated, along with a spreadsheet with the record of her hours and the required signatures. Scanning the forms, Lori says, "Impressive. Who did the spreadsheet? Who do you think?" "Huh." Lori juts out her bottom lip and scribbles something at the top of the form. "So, did you finish?" "Finish what?" Lori gives her a quizzical smile. "Cleaning out the attic. Isn't that what you were supposed to be doing?" "Right, cleaning out the attic." The attic actually is cleaned out. Every single item has been removed from every single box and discussed. Some things have been brought downstairs, and some unsalvageable pieces thrown away. True, most of the stuff got put back in the boxes and is still in the attic. But now the linens are neatly folded. Breakables are carefully wrapped. Molly got rid of boxes that were oddly sized or misshapen or in bad shape and replaced them with new, thick cardboard boxes, uniformly rectangular. Everything is clearly labeled by place and date with a black Sharpie and neatly stacked in chronological sequence under the eaves. You can even walk around up there. "Yeah, it's finished." "You can get a lot done in 50 hours, huh?" Molly nods. "You have no idea," she thinks. Lori opens the file on the table in front of her. "So, look at this. A teacher put a note in here." Suddenly alert, Molly sits forward. "Oh, shit. What now?" Lori lifts the paper slightly, reading it. "Mr. Reed, social studies, says you did an assignment for his class, a portaging project? What's that?" "Just a paper," she says cautiously. "You interviewed a 91-year-old widow. That's the lady you did your hours with, right?" "She just told me some stuff. It wasn't that big a deal." Well, Mr. Reed thinks it is. Says you went above and beyond. He's nominating you for some kind of prize.
What?
A National History Prize. You didn't know about this?
No. She didn't know about this. Mr. Reed hasn't even handed the paper back yet. She shakes her head.
Well, now you do. Lori folds her arms and leans back on her stool. That's pretty exciting, huh?
Molly feels like her skin is glowing, like she's been slathered in some kind of warm, honey-like substance. She feels a grin growing on her face and has to fight to stay cool. She makes an effort to shrug. I probably won't get it or anything.
You probably won't, Lori agrees. But as they say at the Oscars, it's an honor to be nominated.
Load of crap. Lori smiles, and Molly can't help it. She smiles back.
I'm proud of you, Molly. You're doing well.
You're just glad I'm not in juvie. That would count as a fail for you, right?
Right, I'd lose my holiday bonus.
You'd have to sell your Lexus.
Exactly. So, stay out of trouble, okay?
I'll try, Molly says.
No promises.
You don't want your job to get too boring, do you?
No danger of that, Lori says.
The household hums along. Terry keeps to her routine, and Molly pitches in where she can, throwing in a load of laundry and hanging it on the line, making stir-fries and other veggie-heavy dinners for Vivian, who doesn't seem to mind the extra cost and the lack of living creatures on the menu. After some adjustment, Jack is warmed to the idea of Molly living here. For one thing, he can visit her without Dina's disapproving glare. For another, it's a nice place to hang out. In the evenings, they sit on the porch in Vivian's old wicker chairs as the sky turns pink and lavender and red, the colors seeping toward them across the bay, a magnificent living watercolor. One day, to everyone's shock and amazement except Molly's, Vivian announces that she wants to get a computer. Jack calls the phone company to find out how to install Wi-Fi in the house, then sets about getting a modem and wireless router. After talking through the various options, Vivian, who as far as anyone knows has never so much as nudged awake an electronic keyboard, decides to order the same matte silver 13-inch laptop Molly has. She doesn't really know what she'll use it for, she says, just to look things up and maybe read the New York Times. With Vivian hovering at her shoulder, Molly goes to the site and signs in on her own account. Click, click, credit card number, address, click. Okay, free shipping? How long will it take to arrive? Let's see, 5 to 10 business days, or maybe a little longer. Could I get it sooner?
Sure, it just costs a little more.
How much more?
Well, for $23, it can be here in a day or two.
I suppose at my age, there's no point in waiting, is there?
As soon as the laptop arrives, a sleek little rectangular spaceship with a glowing screen, Molly helps Vivian set it up. She bookmarks the New York Times and AARP, why not, and sets up an email account, dailyviv@gmail.com. Though it's hard to imagine Vivian using it. She shows Vivian how to access the tutorial, which she dutifully follows, exclaiming to herself as she goes,
"Ah, that's what that is. You just push that button. Oh, I see. Touchpad. Where's the touchpad? Silly me, of course."
Vivian is a fast study, and soon enough, with a few quick strokes, she discovers a whole community of train riders and their descendants. Nearly 100 of the 200,000 children who rode the trains are still alive. There are books and newspaper articles, plays and events. There's a national orphan train complex based in Concordia, Kansas, with a website that includes riders' testimonies and photographs and a link to FAQs.
Frequently asked questions? Vivian marvels. By whom?
There's a group called the New York Train Riders. The few remaining survivors and their many descendants meet annually in a convent in Little Falls, Minnesota. The Children's Aid Society and the New York Foundling Hospital have websites with links to resources and information about historical records and archives. And there is a whole subgenre of ancestor research, sons and daughters flying to New York, clutching scrapbooks, tracking down letters of indenture, photographs, birth certificates. With help from Molly, Vivian sets up an Amazon account and orders books. There are dozens of children's stories about the trains, but what she's interested in is the documents, the artifacts, the self-published train rider stories, each one a testimony, a telling. Many of the stories, she finds, follow a similar trajectory. This bad thing happened, and this, and I found myself on a train. And this bad thing happened, and this, but I grew up to become a respectable law-abiding citizen. I fell in love. I had children and grandchildren. In short, I've had a happy life. A life that could only have been possible because I was orphaned or abandoned and sent to Kansas or Minnesota or Oklahoma on a train. I wouldn't trade it for the world. So is it just human nature to believe that things happen for a reason? To find some shred of meaning, even in the worst experiences, Molly asks when Vivian reads some of these stories aloud. It certainly helps, Vivian says. She is sitting in one wing back with a laptop, scrolling through stories from the Kansas archives, and Molly, in the other, reading actual books from Vivian's library. She's already plowed through Oliver Twist and is deep into David Copperfield when Vivian squeaks. Molly looks up, startled. She's never heard Vivian make that sound. What is it? I think, Vivian murmurs, her face glowing bluish in the skim milk tint from the screen as she moves two fingers down across the trackpad. I think I may have just found Carmine, the boy from the train. She lifts the computer from her lap and hands it to Molly. The page is titled, Carmine Luton, Minnesota, 1929. They didn't change his name? Apparently not, Vivian says. Look! Here's the woman who took him out of my arms that day. She points at the screen with a curved finger, urging Molly to scroll down. An idyllic childhood, the piece says. They called him Carm. Molly reads on. Carm, it appears, was lucky. He grew up in Park Rapids, married his high school sweetheart, became a salesman like his father. She lingers over the photographs, one taken of him with his new parents, just as Vivian described them. His mother, slight and pretty, his father, tall and thin, chubby Carmine with his dark, curly hair and crossed eyes nestled between them. There's a picture of him on his wedding day, eyes fixed, wearing glasses, beaming beside a round-checked, chestnut-haired girl as they cut a many-tiered white cake. And then one of him bald and smiling, an arm around his plumper but still recognizable wife, with a caption noting their 50th wedding anniversary. Carmine's story has been written by his son, who clearly did lots of research, even making the pilgrimage to New York to scour the records of the Children's Aid Society. The son discovered that Carmine's birth mother, a new arrival from Italy, died in childbirth, and his destitute father gave him up. Carmine, it says in a postscript, died peacefully at the age of 74 in Park Rapids. I like knowing that Carmine had a good life, Vivian says. That makes me happy. Molly goes to Facebook and types in the name of Carmine's son, Carmine Luton Jr. There's only one. She clicks on the photo tab and hands the laptop back to Vivian. I can set up an account for you, if you want. You could send his son a friend request or a Facebook message. Vivian peers at the pictures of Carmine's son with his wife and grandchildren on a recent vacation, at Harry Potter's castle, on a roller coaster, standing next to Mickey Mouse. Good Lord, I'm not ready for that, but... She looks at Molly. You're good at this, aren't you? At what? Finding people. You found your mother. And Maisie. And now this. Oh, well, not really. I just type in some words. I've been thinking about what you said the other day. She breaks in. About looking for the child I gave away. I never told anybody this. But all those years I lived in Hemmingford, any time I saw a girl with blonde hair around her age, my heart jumped. I was desperate to know what became of her. But I thought I had no right. Now I wonder. I wonder if maybe we should try to find her. She looks directly at Molly. Her face is unguarded, full of longing. If I decide that I'm ready, will you help me? Spruce Harbor, Maine, 2011. The phone rings and rings in the cavernous house.
several receivers in different rooms trilling in different keys. Terry? Vivian's voice rises shrilly. Terry, can you get that? Molly, sitting across from Vivian in the living room, puts her book down and starts to rise. Sounds like it's in here. I'm looking for it, Vivi, Terry calls from another room. Is a phone in there? It might be, Vivian says, craning to look around. I can't tell. Vivian is sitting in her favorite chair, the faded red wingback closest to the window, laptop open, nursing a cup of tea. It's another teacher enrichment day at school, and Molly is studying for finals. Though it's mid-morning, they haven't yet opened the curtains. Vivian finds the glare on her screen too strong until about 11. Terry bustles in, half muttering to herself and half to the room. Jeez Louise, this is why I like landlines. I never should have let Jack talk us into cordless. I swear. Oh, here it is. She pulls a receiver out from behind a pillow on the couch. Hello? She pauses, hand on her hip. Yes, this is Mrs. Daly's residence. Can I ask who's calling? She nestles the receiver in her chest. The adoption registry, she stage whispers. Vivian motions her over and takes the phone. She clears her throat. This is Vivian Daly. Molly and Terry lean in closer. Yes, I did. Uh-huh. Yes. Oh. Really? She covers the receiver with her hand. Someone matching the details I submitted had already filled out a form. Molly can hear the voice of the woman on the other end of the line, a tinny melody. What's that you say? Vivian puts the phone to her ear again and cocks her head, listening to the answer. 14 years ago, she tells Molly and Terry. 14 years ago, Terry exclaims. A mere 10 days ago, after rooting around on the internet for a little while, Molly located a cache of adoption registry services, narrowing her search to the one rated highest among users, the site, described as a system for matching people who want to establish contact with their next of kin by birth, seemed reputable and above board, non-profit, no fee required. Molly emailed the link for the application form to herself at school, where she printed it off for Vivian to fill in, a scant 2 pages, with the names of the town, the hospital, the adoption agency. At the post office, Molly made a photocopy of the birth certificate, which Vivian has kept in a small box under her bed for all these years, with the original name, May, she gave her daughter. Then she put the forms and the photocopy in a manila envelope addressed to the agency and mailed them off, fully expecting to hear nothing for weeks or months, or possibly ever. Do I have a pen? Vivian mutters, looking around. Do I have a pen? Molly hurries into the kitchen and rummages through the junk drawer, pulling out a handful of writing implements, then scribbling on the closest paper at hand, the Mount Desert Islander, to find one that actually has ink. She brings a blue ballpoint and the newspaper back to Vivian. Yes, yes, all right. Yes, that's fine, Vivian is saying. Now, how do you spell that? D-U-N-N. Setting the newspaper on the round table next to her chair, she writes a name, phone number, and email address above the headline, laboring over the at sign. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Squinting at the receiver, she clicks the off button. Terry goes to the tall windows and pulls back the drapes, fastening the loops on each side. The light that floods in is hard and bright. For heaven's sake, now I can't see a thing, Vivian scolds, shading her screen with her hand. Oh, sorry, do you want me to close them? It's all right. Vivian shuts her laptop. She peers at the newspaper as if the digits she printed on it are some kind of code. So, what did you find out? Molly asks. Her name is Sarah Dunnell. Vivian looks up. She lives in Fargo, North Dakota. North Dakota? Are they sure you're related? They say they're sure. They've checked and cross-checked birth records. She was born on the same day, in the same hospital. Vivian's voice quavers. Her original name was May. Oh, my God. Molly touches Vivian's knee. It is her. Vivian clasps her hands in her lap. It's her. This is really exciting. It's terrifying, Vivian says. So, what happens next? Well, a phone call, I suppose.
Or an email. I have her email address. She holds up the newspaper. Molly leans forward. Which do you want to do?
I'm not sure.
A call would be more immediate. It might startle her. She's been waiting for this for a long time.
That's true. Vivian seems to hesitate. I don't know.
Everything is moving so fast. After 70 years, Molly smiles. I have an idea. Let's Google her first and see what we find. Vivian makes an abracadabra motion with her hand over the silver laptop. Fast. Sarah Dunnell, it turns out, is a musician. She played violin with the Fargo Symphony Orchestra and taught at North Dakota State University until her retirement several years ago. She's a member of the Rotary Club and has been married twice, for many years to a lawyer and now to a dentist who is on the symphony board. She has a son and a daughter who appear to be in their early 40s, and at least three grandchildren. In the dozen or so photos in Google Images, mostly headshots of Sarah with her violin and Rotary Award ceremony groupings, she is slim, like Vivian, with an alert, guarded expression, and blonde hair.
I suppose she dyes it, Vivian says. Don't we all, Molly says. I never did.
We can't all have gorgeous silver hair like yours, Molly says. Things happen quickly now. Vivian sends Sarah an email. Sarah calls. Within days, she and her dentist husband have booked a flight to Maine for early June. They'll bring their 11-year-old granddaughter, Becca, who grew up reading Blueberries for Sal and is, Sarah says, always up for an adventure. Vivian reads some of the emails out loud to Molly.
I always wondered about you, Sarah writes. I'd given up hope of ever finding out who you are and why you gave me away.
It's exciting, this getting ready business. A troop of workers marches through the house, painting trim, fixing broken baluster shafts on the porch facing the bay, cleaning the oriental rugs, and patching the cracks in the wall that appear every spring when the ground thaws and the house resettles.
It's time to open up all the rooms, don't you think? Vivian says one morning over breakfast. Let the air in.
To keep the bedroom doors from slamming shut in the wind from the bay, they prop them open with old hand irons Molly found in one of the boxes in the attic. Having all those doors and windows open on the second floor creates a breeze that blows through the house. Everything seems lighter somehow, open to the elements. Without asking Molly's assistance, Vivian orders some new clothes for herself from Talbot's on her laptop with a credit card.
Vivian ordered clothes from Talbot's on her laptop with a credit card.
Can you believe those words just came out of my mouth? Molly tells Jack.
Before we know it, frogs will be falling from the sky, he says.
Other signs of the apocalypse proliferate. After a pop-up ad appears on her screen, Vivian announces that she plans to sign up for Netflix. She buys a digital camera on Amazon with one click. She asks Molly if she's ever seen the Sneezing Baby Panda video on YouTube. She even joins Facebook. She sent her daughter a friend request, Molly tells Jack.
Did she accept?
Right away. They shake their heads. Two sets of cotton sheets are taken from the linen closet and washed, then hung to dry on the long clothesline beside the house. When Molly plucks them off the line, the sheets are stiff and sweet-smelling. She helps Terry make the beds, stretching the clean white sheets over mattresses that have never been used. When is the last time any of them felt this kind of anticipation? Even Terry has gotten into the spirit. I wonder what kind of cereal I should get for Becca, Terry muses as they drape the Irish wreath quilt on the girl's bed, across the hall from her grandparents' suite.
Honey Nut Cheerios are always a safe bet, Molly says.
I think she'd prefer pancakes. Do you think she'd like blueberry pancakes?
Who doesn't like blueberry pancakes?
In the kitchen, while Molly cleans out cabinets and Jack tightens the latches on the screen door, they discuss what Sarah and her family might want to do on the island. Stroll around Bar Harbor, get ice cream at Ben and Bill's, eat steamed lobster at Thurston's, maybe try Nona's, the new southern Italian place in Spruce Harbor that got a rave in Down East. She's not here to do touristy things. She's here to meet her birth mother, Terry reminds them. They look at each other and start laughing. Oh, yeah. That's right,
Jack says. Molly is following Sarah's son, Stephen, on Twitter. The day of the flight, Stephen writes,
Mom's off to meet her 91-year-old birth mother. Go figure. A whole new life at the age of 68.
A whole new life. It's a Maine postcard day. All the rooms in the house are ready. A large pot of fish chowder, Terry's specialty, simmers on the stove with a smaller pot of corn chowder, a nod to Molly, beside it. Cornbread cools on the counter. Molly has made a big salad and balsamic dressing. Molly and Vivian have been roaming around all afternoon, pretending not to watch the clock. Jack called at 2 p.m. to say that the flight from Minnesota landed in Boston a few minutes late, but the puddle jumper to Bar Harbor Airport had taken off and was scheduled to land in half an hour, and he was on his way. He'd taken Vivian's car, a navy blue Subaru wagon, to pick them up, after vacuuming it out and giving it a good wash with dishwashing liquid and a hose in his driveway. Sitting in the rocker in the kitchen, looking out at the water, Molly feels oddly at peace. For the first time since she can remember, her life is beginning to make sense. What up until this moment has felt like a random, disconnected series of unhappy events, she now views as necessary steps in a journey toward enlightenment is perhaps too strong a word, but there are others, less lofty, like self-acceptance and perspective. She has never believed in fate. It would have been dispiriting to accept that her life so far unfolded as it did according to some preordained pattern. But now she wonders, if she hadn't been bounced from one foster home to the next, she wouldn't have ended up on this island and met Jack, and through him, Vivian. She would never have heard Vivian's story, with all its resonance to her own. When the car pulls into the driveway, Molly hears the crunch of gravel from the kitchen at the opposite end of the house. She's been listening for it. Vivian, they're here, she calls. I hear, Vivian calls back. Meeting in the foyer, Molly reaches for Vivian's hand. This is it, she thinks, the culmination of everything. But all she says is, ready?
Ready, Vivian says.
As soon as Jack shuts off the engine, a girl springs from the back seat, wearing a blue striped dress and white sneakers. Becca, it must be. She has red hair. Long, wavy red hair and a smattering of freckles. Vivian, gripping the porch rail with one hand, puts her other over her mouth. Oh. Oh, Molly breathes behind her. The girl waves. Vivian, we're here! The blonde woman getting out of the car, Sarah, looks toward them with an expression Molly's never seen before. Her eyes are wide open, searching. And when her gaze alights on Vivian's face, it is startling in its intensity, stripped of any pretense or convention. Yearning and wariness and hopefulness and love. Does Molly really see all this on Sarah's face, or is she projecting? She looks at Jack, lifting the bags out of the trunk, and he nods and gives her a slow wink.
I get it. I feel it, too.
Molly touches Vivian's shoulder, frail and bony under her thin silk cardigan. She half turns, half smiles, her eyes brimming with tears. Her hand flutters to her clavicle, to the silver chain around her neck, the Clada charm. Those tiny hands clasping a crowned heart, love, loyalty, friendship, a never-ending path that leads away from home. And circles back. What a journey Vivian and this necklace have taken, Molly thinks. From a cobblestoned village on the coast of Ireland, to a tenement in New York, to a train, filled with children, steaming westward through farmland, to a lifetime in Minnesota. And now to this moment, nearly 100 years after it all began, on the porch of an old house in Maine. Vivian puts her foot on the first step and stumbles slightly, and each person moves toward her, as if in slow motion. Molly just behind her, Becca nearing the bottom step, Jack at the car, Sarah crossing the gravel, even Terry coming around the side of the house. I'm all right, Vivian says, grasping the rail. Molly slips an arm around her waist. "Of course you are," she whispers. Her voice is steady, though her heart is so full it aches. "And I'm right here behind you." Vivian smiles. She looks down at Becca, who is gazing up at her with large hazel eyes.
"Now then, where shall we begin?"
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Orphan Train, a novel. Written by Christina Baker Klein. Narrated by Jessica Almacy, with Suzanne Torin. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2013 by Christina Baker Klein. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.